So I'm going to talk about Big Bang nucleosynthesis, Z primes, and Dirac neutrinos in some interconnected way. And the heart of it is work that I did very recently with Vernon and a graduate student, Hai-Sung Lee from Madison. And it's on HepPH 03-02066. And basically the plan of what I'm going to say is I'm going to spend a couple of minutes talking about anti-seesawism. A little about Z prime physics and why I consider the possibility of a heavy Z prime to be very well motivated. A little brief review of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, both the standard and involving new interactions, and the results and implications. And of course, the basic thrust of all of this is that there is a possibility that neutrinos are Dirac rather than Majorana. And in fact, if there is a U1 prime gauge symmetry surviving to relatively low energies, it may very well make forbid the possibility of a conventional gut seesaw, forcing one into an alternative, of which a Dirac neutrino is one possibility. Once you have Dirac neutrinos, you have to worry about whether they would have been produced in equilibrium numbers or in any numbers prior to Big Bang nucleosynthesis, in which case they would contribute extra energy density and therefore increase the helium abundance. And so one can tie all of this together to constrain the possibilities. And I should say that all of this program is dates back to work that Gary did with Keith Olive and Dave Schramm, in 1979 or so. And so basically what we did was we decided to take these set of ideas, which from the astrophysical point of view 25 years ago were very carefully developed, but from the particle physics point of view was just done in a sort of qualitative way, and really apply it in specific detail to a class of Z prime models.
In a scheme like this, there's no neutrinos double beta decay?
Correct. Okay, first of all, everybody knows that the usual gut seesaw is a strong contender for the explanation for neutrino masses, because it gives the right scale of masses, a fraction of an electron volt sort of drops out naturally, and it also fits in very nicely to the leptogenesis scenario of baryogenesis, in which the heavy Majorana neutrinos, the right-handed neutrinos so-called, which are heavy in Majorana, and their decays can create a lepton asymmetry, which is later converted to a baryon asymmetry. However, there's one major problem and a few small problems. And the major problem is large mixing angles. The traditional gut seesaw, in its simplest implementation, would predict that the neutrino mixing angle should be the same as the quark mixing angles, or at least comparable to it. And I think just about anybody writing down a grand unified seesaw model who didn't know the answer would have predicted that, or unless they just go through a variety of 25 models and laundry list. Now, there are ways, and so this is I think it's hard to claim a great triumph for the gut seesaw model, given that the mixing angles are large. I mean, the whole nature of grand unification is that leptons and quarks should be similar, not different. Now, of course, there are ways out, and I'm perfectly aware that there's lots of papers and models on the market that one way or another evade this problem. And for example, fine-tuned heavy neutrino textures. If one writes down a mass matrix for the three heavy Majorana neutrinos and puts a very fine-tuned pattern of zeros and hierarchies, you can get around this. Or there are other clever ways, such as the lopsided models, which through non-trivial dynamics generate highly asymmetric mass matrices for the down quarks and for the charged leptons, so that the large mixings are for the neutrinos are actually not in the neutrinos but are in the left-handed electron sector, and there are corresponding large mixings in the right-handed down quark sector which are not observable. So there are ways out, but nevertheless they're merely clever ways out. It's not something that has the ring of inevitability, if you will. Another problem is that, as I'll say, many extensions of the standard model involving unification in one form or another, or even things like dynamical symmetry breaking, predict the existence of extra U1 prime gauge symmetries which may survive to the TEV scale. And it's if you have some large gauge group, it's often very difficult to break these extra U1 prime gauge symmetries. So it's certainly one should bear in mind that there may be extra gauge symmetries. And if the right-handed neutrinos that one invokes for the seesaw, if these are charged under the U1 prime gauge symmetry, then the U1 prime gauge symmetry does not allow Majorana masses for those charged particles at scales larger than the U1 prime breaking. I'll call it your new right is just will represent the singlet neutrino that is the right-handed partner of the ordinary neutrino if it's Dirac, or this is the guy that becomes super heavy in a seesaw model. If there's an extra U1 prime and this is carries a charge, then Majorana mass term cannot develop at a scale much larger than the U1 prime breaking scale. And if this is a TEV, then you can't generate a 10 to the 14 GEV mass. So,
well, you indicate that in many theories there are these extra U1 primes that don't get broken easily. Mm-hmm. Then why do they get broken at a TEV scale?
By the same processes that break the electroweak symmetry. What I mean is it's easy to take a theory that has, say, a large gauge symmetry and break it down to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 cross U1 to some number, and then you can break it at the electroweak scale. Sometimes you can break it larger. I'm just saying many, many models will lead to this. Some string models, by which I mean simple perturbative heterotic string models, often forbid many of the ingredients of the, or don't lead to guts or large Higgs representations needed to break the guts, or large Higgs representations needed to generate large Majorana masses for the right-handed neutrinos, etc. It's very hard to implement these, at least in some restricted classes of string models. I'm not saying it's universal. Finally, should it turn out that LSND is correct and that there really are four neutrinos, that is a fourth sterile neutrino, that mixes significantly with the ordinary neutrinos, and that would mean, for example, that one or more of these guys are light, but actually mix with the ordinary neutrinos significantly, which involves basically Majorana and Dirac mass terms that are both small and comparable. It's very hard to implement that sort of thing into a gut seesaw. Again, I'm not saying model builders are clever and you can find dozens of papers on the market doing it, but it's hard. So for these reasons, I think it is useful to explore alternatives. Yeah?
Let me contribute to another problem. Leptogenesis requires producing heavy neutrinos at some temperature. And if your favorite scale is 10 to the 12 GeV, that means that the key temperature after inflation could be at least 10 to the 12 GeV. Now, people who, if string theory is right, then we have all sorts of moduli fields. And not to overclose the universe by moduli, one needs to reheat temperature 10 to the 9 GeV or lower. And so that creates a problem. Of course, one can try to push the heavy neutrino scale down to 10 to the 9 GeV, and that can be done, but that lessens the motivation, that requires the motivation for the gut
system. Yeah, once you've done that, then this doesn't work anymore, and you have to then fix that up somehow. Thank you. So I think for these reasons, I'm not saying the seesaw is excluded by any means, but I think it's worthwhile to at least explore, think in terms of possible alternatives, and there are many alternatives. The ordinary gut seesaw, and the one possibility is that there really are small Dirac masses, in which case the ordinary SU2 doublet neutrinos have partners that are these SU2 singlets, which are just like the partners one adds for the charged leptons and quarks. Of course, one then has to ask, why are the masses small? I'm not going to address that today. There are many, other than this right now, to say there are lots of candidates on the market for models which lead to small Dirac masses. For example, large extra-dimensional theories can give small Dirac masses via a volume effect if the right-handed field propagates in the bulk. And I've been involved in some models involving higher dimensional operators, such as, for example, if the term in the Lagrangian that generates neutrino masses is not just an elementary Yukawa. So, on this. This is the lepton doublet. This is just the CP conjugate of this, sterile left-handed CP conjugate. This is the Higgs doublet. If one has an elementary Yukawa coupling here, then of course one has to ask, why is it so small? But it could be that something like a U1 prime gauge symmetry or some other dynamics forbids an elementary coupling, but allows some higher dimensional operator, S over M Planck to P, where P is an integer, and S is an SU2 cross U1 singlet field, but which can acquire a VEB, and then if this acquires some VEB, say 10 to the 12 GeV or something, dividing by the Planck scale, it would give a naturally suppressed Dirac mass. One can construct models that give small Dirac masses, or which give mixing between ordinary and sterile neutrinos, which one would want for the LS&D, by schemes like this. And in particular, it's easy to construct schemes involving, again, U1 prime gauge symmetries, which have flat directions to implement schemes like this. So there are models that do this. One can also have so-called TEV seesaws. Were you involved in that with Robbie? I forget. Yeah. These are models that really make use of a TeV scale rather than 10 to the 14 GeV as the large seesaw mass, but have added suppressions so that one can get Majorana masses that are small, but the, so that the right-handed partners may be at the TeV scale rather than light. And then there are things like loop-induced models or R-parity violation in SUSY tree or loop level. There's lots of alternatives on the markets. So I'm going to, let me now switch and say a little about U1 prime gauge symmetries. For example, specific string constructions often lead to U1 prime, extra U1 prime factors below the string scale. Grand unified theories bigger than SU5 may lead to extra U1 primes. Also, in a completely different domain, models of dynamical symmetry breaking often lead to extra U1 primes. In the gut case, probably the Z prime mass would be at the gut scale. That is, as you know, in a grand unified theory, one has to do a fine tuning of some sort to get the electroweak scale small compared to the gut scale. If there's an extra U1 prime, you have to do a second fine tuning to get the Z prime, much less than the gut scale. So although one could, it's less motivated. Often in the specific string type constructions that people look like, such as stuff I looked at with Miriam Svedek, the MZ prime is of order of TeV if radiative breaking. I don't want to go off into a lot of detail on this. For example, supergravity mediated supersymmetry breaking models, whether string derived or not, the basic electroweak symmetry breaking is due to the fact that the Higgs and other scalar mass squares are positive at the large scale and of the same order of, they're supersymmetry breaking scales, and then large Yukawa couplings, say associated with the top quark, drive them negative at low energies with a natural scale comparable to the supersymmetry breaking scale. When you add an extra U1 prime into the game, the same thing happens. That goes along and tends to want to have also be driven to have things like this S-field singlets that can break the U1 prime are also driven to have negative mass squares at the electroweak scale. And so it's sort of natural that one can get C prime masses comparable to the electroweak scale. So supergravity mediated models. Similar things actually happen in gauge mediated models of supersymmetry breaking. And so it's fairly easy to get this type of electroweak scale. In fact, the problem is more to keep it up at the TeV level than to keep it small. There are loopholes, or I shouldn't say loopholes, unless flat directions. Sometimes in these models, even though some of the scalar mass squares are of the electroweak scale and negative, sometimes there are directions in the space of scalar field expectation values that are F and D flat, and in which basically a field will naturally go to something like 10 to the 12 GeV or so. That's what I had in mind when I was talking about this. So there's sort of two alternatives here, either electroweak scale or intermediate scale, and it generally just depends on whether some sum of scalar mass squares is positive or negative, whether you get one or the other. Or you could get, if there's more than one U1, you could get one that's electroweak and one's intermediate scale, and I want to mention that right at the end of my talk. If there were an extra U1 prime, it's has at least one benefit. In supersymmetry, One of the difficulties is the so-called mu problem, which stated basically is in the MSSM, one can write a supersymmetry conserving mass term for the Higgs fields and their superpartners. And phenomenologically, that mass term must be comparable to the scale of supersymmetry breaking, but it's supersymmetric. So it could just as well have been 10 to the 16 GeV. That's called the mu problem. In models with an extra U1 prime, in many cases, the actual term, well, the term I'm referring to in the superpotential is this mu, which has to be small, but could be large, times product of two Higgs doublets. This is in the superpotential. It's a mass term. This is the MSSM. But in models with a U1 prime, often either because of the U1 prime or because of some string selection rule, mu is zero. But there's instead some trilinear term with some coefficient h times a field that breaks the U1 prime times hu hd. And in such models, the effective mu is h times the expectation value of this field. So if this is at the TeV or 100 GeV level, it's a natural explanation of the mu problem. It's somewhat similar to the so-called NMSSM, in which one introduces, that's an extension in which one of the MSSM with an extra field but without a U1 prime. However, in that case, those models are plagued by discrete symmetries and domain walls, whereas here one doesn't have those problems. Experimentally, the limits on a U1 prime are extremely model dependent, or not extremely, but are somewhat model dependent, because a given U1 prime model involves a mass, it involves an angle delta, which is the mixing between the Z and Z prime, it involves the gauge coupling G Z prime, it involves the chiral couplings, what the chiral charges of the left and right-handed quarks, the left and right-handed leptons, etc. And so it's hard to be completely general. But generally, the experimental limits now are, in simple models, between 500 and 800 GeV. Combination of precision electroweak and direct searches at the Tevatron by CDF for quark, anti-quark makes a Z prime, goes to E plus E minus or mu plus mu minus. And delta, the ZZ prime mixing angle, severely constrained by Z-pole data because it would mess up the Z couplings and mass. So this delta is less than a few times 10 to the minus 3. Okay, so a Z prime probably is not at the electroweak scale. It's probably not 100 GeV. It must be about 10 times larger, except for very specific cases. The and certainly there are a lot of models on the market that do this. Sometimes some of the models that do this use a modest, I'll write it in the negative way, modest fine-tuning of parameters, by which I mean that one's just talking about, you know, small but not infinitesimally small regions of the parameters of the various soft masses, etc. Or there was something I'm not going to describe, but I think a very interesting set of models that Jens Ehler and Tenjin Lee and I described last year. And basically, it involves that there's more than one of these fields that can break the U1 prime, and they sort of find themselves in two sectors that are only loosely coupled, and one can very easily get a TeV scale. And those models have a lot of other consequences, which we're exploring. But okay.
More strings bound than 500 to 800, are those a particular
These are basically the models that are based on the couplings in the E6 group, which is the ones I'm going to stick with. Generally not. If you took the sequential model, people often talk about the sequential Z prime. That's a model in which the Z prime has the same couplings as the Z. There you get more stringent limits, but you don't get models like that in gauge theories, except incredibly complicated ones.
This couple is different in different flavors?
I'll say a word about that in a moment. Okay, so I should say there are many implications of this. And let me emphasize that my view is that extra Z prime is probably the best motivated physics beyond the MSSM. I mean, I think supersymmetry is the best motivated new physics, but beyond that, I think extra U1 prime at low energies. Usually, these models are associated with exotics, that is, new chiral supermultiplets, such as things that occur like down quarks, in which both left and right handed heavy exotic down is a SU2 singlet, or things of that nature. The string derived models, not the gut ones, but the ones that come from strings, often generally have family non-universal couplings. This is Sasha's question, and therefore can lead to Faber changing neutral current effects. And experimentally, the constraints from the mu decays and k decays are so stringent that any model that had different couplings for the first two generations is excluded. But certainly one could tolerate the third family being different. That's even a possible explanation of the forward-backward asymmetry in the bottom quarks from LEP. So Faber-changing neutral currents is certainly a possibility, I'm not going to come back to that today, but especially in the string type versions, it's very plausible. And Vernon and I have been talking about possible implications there for B physics, for rare B decays. Also, non-standard Higgs and Suzy spectra and properties. For example, models like this will have, they're generally extra scalars, more complicated gauginal neutralino sectors, and these secluded sector models tend to have light Higgs's are large admixtures of SU2 singlets and doublets, very different properties. Some of the models lead to the squarks and sleptons being heavy, like TEV scale, but just very different. Okay, as I've said, there's too many parameters to really talk in a completely general way. And so we've done some analyses involving specific models coming from heterotic string constructions, et cetera, but I'm going to focus today just on the E6 models, which are a nice class of models that many authors in many contexts have focused on. I should say that one issue is that if there's an extra U1 prime, you want to make sure your theory is anomaly free. And that's a very complicated constraint. And if you just start totally bottom up with an extra U1 prime, it's not easy to make it anomaly free. And no matter, you have to add exotic particles with U1 prime charges, et cetera. But the E6 grand unified theory provides a model of two types of U1 primes that are automatically anomaly free and have all the right quantum numbers. I want to say I'm not going to be assuming E6 grand unification. Only the quantum numbers of the U1 primes is a simple model. In fact, if you had a real E6 model and tried to have a U1 prime survive to low energies, not only would it require fine tuning, but it would lead to particles that are necessarily light that could mediate proton decay. So I'm taking this purely as a model of the couplings, not as a full grand unified theory. the E6 can break, again, I'm just talking about the quantum numbers here and not the actual dynamics, the SO10 cross U1, and this U1 is usually called the psi. That's just a name for this particular set of quantum numbers. And SO10 can break to SU5 cross another U1 called the chi. Those are traditional names. And the charges of the ordinary particles under these two groups are, well, for the U, D, and minus UR and minus ER. These are just together in an SU5 multiplet, and by minus UR, what I really mean is minus the charge of the right-handed up quark is minus 1 over 2 root 10 and 1 over 2 root 6. And then the left-handed neutrinos, the left-handed electron, and minus the coupling to the right-handed down quark in these models is 3 over 2 root 10 and 1 over 2 root 6. And then these models involve a right-handed neutrino, at least, you know, SO10 contains, you know, 15 fields plus a right-handed neutrino for a family. And these have charges 5 over 2 root 10 and minus 1 over 2 root 6. There are also some additional multiplets, such as those involving the Higgses, that I'm not going to write down right now, and some exotics, but this I just wanted to make it concrete. People often will consider it a case in which there could be two U1s, two Z primes that survive the low energies. But people, just to simplify the discussion, usually assume that there's only one that survives the low energy and one that gets broken somehow at a higher scale. And one could consider, these are two of the models that one considers, but more generally people talk about a class of models in which it's some linear combination parameterized by an angle theta E6 that survives. And so I will work in this class of models. The chi is theta equals 0. This one is theta equals pi over 2. There's a famous model called the eta model, historically famous, and this is one in which theta E6 is 2 pi minus tangent inverse of root 5/3. And this particular pattern is called the eta model. It emerged in some early string-inspired constructions, but it's only mainly of historical interest. But this, by the way, is 1.71 pi. Okay, so now, these are the charges that we will consider. That gives us this. And I will use mz prime as a variable and see how things depend on it. One has to specify the charges. And if you have at some stage again, I don't need to assume full unification, but if you have a large group involved that breaks directly to the standard model cross U1 and evolve with the all the evolutions of the E6 model for the gauge couplings, one finds that the GZ prime divided by the coupling of the ordinary Z, which is GZ prime divided what G1 squared plus G2 squared. These are just the U1 and SU2 couplings of the standard model. In some simple scheme, this comes out to be sine root 5/3 times sine of the weak angle. And we'll just use that. One can generally scale results for different values of the couplings. And finally, the ZZ prime mixing delta. The actual experimental limits on this are like 0.002. now, typically. And that's actually very weak limit for my purposes. And if one stuck to that, one would find unrealistically large effects, I think, in nucleosynthesis. I'm going to use, we've considered various ansatzes about the mixing, but there's this theoretical one. If you actually write down a concrete model with specific Higgs fields that not only give mass to the Z prime and to the Z, but cause the mixing, you will always come out with a relation like this, a theoretical relation, when MZ prime is large compared to MZ. The coefficient is model dependent, but basically, in the E6 models, if you only use Higgs fields that occur in the same multiplets as everything else, it's bounded between -1 and 1. Yes.
Sometimes in theories like this, there are kinetic mixing things that are that ordered.
Yeah. We have not included kinetic mixing. It's in principle one could consider it, but we have not tried to do, you know, every possible Z prime model. The kinetic mixing would not introduce new couplings to this, since this is a standard model singlet. But you're certainly right. That would be yet another dimension that one could take, and one could, you know, vary this relation or consider other types of models. But we were trying to be within a reasonable class, but certainly not the most general. Yeah, he's referring to a type of mixing. Yeah, it's F mu nu prime. Yeah. Yeah, you can generate these in guts by RGE effects. And certainly they can be important in some contexts. But okay, now let me remind you about some elementary facts about Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And in slightly beyond the standard version, there are three input parameters to Big Bang nucleosynthesis. One is eta, which is just the ratio of the baryon to the photon density, which is constrained by tightly by the deuterium, primordial deuterium abundance, and also now independently by the CMB. So this is well known. The deuterium abundance depends sensitively on this. The helium-4 less so. But it's basically known. Delta N nu, well, you know, in Big Bang nucleosynthesis, everything is in the helium abundance is a competition between the expansion rate, which is sensitive to every source of energy density, including things like these right-handed neutrinos, if they're present, competition of that against a weak interaction rate. If there were new species, delta N nu is represents new contributions to the energy density. In units of additional neutrino flavors. So when it says that the number of ordinary neutrinos is 3 plus delta N nu, if you like, but the delta N nu really can parameterize any type of new energy density, whether it's neutrinos or anything else. And also, the chemical potential of the electron neutrinos, which would represent an asymmetry between nu e and nu e bar. And the relation is that the number density of one minus the other over t cubed is 1/6 of psi e plus psi e cubed over pi squared. If this were big, you know, of order 0.1 or 0.01 or something, it would affect things significantly for a reason I'll state in just a moment. Asymmetries in the mu and tau neutrinos are just can be, they're irrelevant except for the energy density, and they can be lumped into this effect of delta N nu. Yeah, this affects the actual reaction rates. And basically, these asymmetries are the only efficient way that I know of to sort of cancel, at least even in a fine-tuned way, the effects of new energy density. Extra energy density makes too much helium-4 compared to observations. And about the only efficient way of counteracting that would be to put in an asymmetry here. But I should emphasize that one would need asymmetries of the order of 0.01 or something, and not of the 10 to the minus 10 that we see for everything else. But the standard Big Bang nucleosynthesis sets this and this to zero. But a whole class of new things like these models we're talking about fit into this scheme.
I guess there are also limits from structure formation and CMGR, right? Because large psi delays the net radiation equality, and that affects the structure and CMGR. I think there's limits. Yeah. For smaller mega lambda, they would actually favor than zero psi.
Yeah.
But for mega lambda around 0.7, 0.8, there's a limit on the psi from that.
Okay. I don't think at present the limits are stringent enough to say that one shouldn't consider it in this context, because the BBM is extremely sensitive because it affects directly a reaction rate.
The limit is around 0.1, yeah. So if you want anything below 0.1.
Yeah, here we're talking about typically about 0.01 and so forth. Okay, so of course what's going on now is that one is considering reaction rates for these processes, and these processes keep the rate, the numbers of neutrons to protons in equilibrium as long as they're occurring as fast as the expansion rate. And once they drop, they basically decouple. So basically, the rate for these processes is the weak interactions. It's some numerical coefficient times G Fermi squared times temperature to the fifth, and which comes about some number density of target particles times the thermal average of cross-section times relative velocity, and that goes like G Fermi squared T to the fifth. And the expansion rate is basically 1.66 G star to the 1/2 times temperature squared over M Planck. And G star is some measure of the number of degrees of freedom in equilibrium at that time. It's the number of bosonic degrees plus 7/8 the fermionic degrees. And I'm going to lump, if one allows these extra energy sources, I'm going to just lump it, whatever its origin, into the fermionic thing, because all we really care about is this G star. So the point is, if there's extra neutrinos or extra sources of energy density, then the universe expands faster. That means the decoupling occurs earlier at a higher temperature when there's more neutrons and there's more helium-4. And in fact, the decoupling occurs at some T star for which gamma W T star is equal to H of T star. And T star is G star to the 1/2 over G Fermi squared M Planck. There are constants that I'm not writing, to the 1/3. And it's a few MeV. And then one has that the number density of neutrons over protons.
Just a couple of comments.
comments. I mean, this is a nice qualitative way to think about things, but there's never freeze-out. The weakened directions keep going. They just can't keep up with equilibrium.
Sure.
But they're always driving neutrons towards protons.
Yeah.
It's just more slowly than an exponential.
Sure.
But if you make that calculation, then this point where it occurs, as I recall, is something like 800 kilovolts, a little bit below.
Okay, I'm only trying to give a sort of qualitative thing for the people who don't know it here.
The QWB is when actually neutrinos decouple from the rest of the plasma.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. I'm not making any use of the specific things, just trying to give a sort of qualitative orientation here. So the number density is then at this freeze-out is before the neutrons have had time to decay, et cetera. It's just the mass difference over T star. And if there is a chemical potential and asymmetry, then there's an extra term here. And this is because if there's an excess of nu E over nu E bar, it drives this reaction this way and depletes the neutron abundance. And then from this, one can calculate trivially in the sort of hand-waving way I'm doing here, the abundance of helium-4 over hydrogen, and it's about 24%. In the standard model by mass. The real calculation, as Gary emphasized, is incredibly complicated, et cetera, but just the basics of it is this. So the bottom line is this works pretty well in the standard model with psi equal to zero and in nu equal zero, but if you vary those things, you get two, you can change the helium prediction, and now how much change one can tolerate depends on who you ask. It depends sensitively on the observations as well as the theory, but sort of a very crude estimate is that minus 1.5 less than delta in nu, less than about 0.3. Some authors would argue that you could go up to 1. Some authors might argue that it's hard to even get up to zero here. This is for psi equals zero, but if crudely you can compensate by psi here, if it's positive, with a huge coefficient of something of order 18 or so. Again, this is only qualitative. Okay, so now I'm going to basically ignore this, and I'll simply say that the LSND induced 4 new schemes generally imply delta in nu equals 1, probably not tolerable. And this is one of the reasons that, apart from the fact that it doesn't fit the data very well, it's one of the reasons that people are very skeptical about these 4 neutrino schemes. But of course, the emphasis here is let's consider a Dirac neutrino. Again, so I'm not talking about LSND. In LSND, one has 3 ordinary active neutrinos, which and then 1 sterile neutrino, and somehow they mix with each other, so there's 4 light neutrinos. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a Dirac neutrinos now with conserved lepton number. So one has 3 additional degrees of freedom in these 3 right-handed neutrinos for the 3 families. And so the question is, how much is that going to contribute to this delta in nu? How many would have been produced prior to Big Bang nucleosynthesis? Now, the good news is that if you just take the standard model with small m nu, then the delta in nu is negligible because the nu right is really sterile. It really doesn't interact. It's not quite sterile. Interacts via m nu and the associated Higgs-Yukawa couplings. That is, if you have a Dirac neutrino, normally, if, just as an example, suppose you have some weak process that produces a neutrino, you generally produce an active neutrino, a left-handed neutrino or right-handed antineutrino. The amplitude to produce nu R is suppressed by m nu over the energy of the neutrino, which is m nu over temperature, crudely. I'm not there yet.
Okay.
I said if you had the standard model with small neutrino, it's not a problem. Because the amplitude, if m nu were zero, it would be totally decoupled, sterile, you'd never produce it. And so at some early time, and one can trace back, these would have been in equilibrium early on, but the decoupling of the nu right turns out to be about 10 to the 8 TeV if the mass is an electron volt, up 0.1 electron volt. So these would have been produced in equilibrium at temperatures more in excess of 10 to the 8 TeV, but then they dropped out. And subsequently, all kinds of other stuff, W's and supersymmetric particles and so forth, annihilated when they dropped out of equilibrium, reheating everything lighter, but not the new R's. And so basically, these would be negligible today. This was a constraint in the days of Simpson, 17 keV, et cetera, but not for the neutrinos we know and love now. However, no. They decoupled? No, absolutely not. They were never in equilibrium subsequent to 10 to the 8 TeV, and so they're not there. And they certainly.
I think he wants to know what happened to them, and they just got diluted because there was so much.
Diluted to a negligible level. And the ordinary neutrinos, conceivably, if there were a big magnetic moment or something, the ordinary neutrinos passing through a magnetic field could have conceivably precessed at some later time, but that wouldn't have even made extra neutrinos. It would have just modified the ordinary ones. So they just don't contribute to anything significantly. However, all these pieces are fine if it not were not for the evil machinations of Gary Steigman, who told us 25 years ago that everything I've just told you, any part of what I've just told you is fine, but putting them all together is a problem. Because Olive Steigman-Schramm, 79, argued, I'll just state it in for Z prime, the argument is any interaction of these things, including W primes, etc. If you have an extra U1 prime, then the new right is not really sterile. It has weak interactions or super weak interactions due to these couplings. And those interactions could have produced it. And for example, processes such as E plus E minus goes to Z prime, goes to new right bar, would have been a very efficient way of producing these things. If one just estimates the super weak interaction strength of this as the Fermi constant times mz over mz prime squared, which is dimensionally, you know, a reasonable first approximation. It assumes that all the couplings are the same, but, you know, roughly. Then one has that the decoupling, I'm running out of time, so I won't go through all the steps. This would have stayed in equilibrium until a decoupling of around G super weak over G, no, G Fermi over G super weak to the 2/3 times the decoupling of the light neutrinos. Again, I'm talking loosely, but this is a border on MeV or so. And so even if G super weak is, you know, 100 times G Fermi, this is not all that you know, stays in equilibrium for a long time. So it would have been very efficiently produced. And so one might expect delta in nu to be 3 if there's 3 families. But it's not quite that bad. Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Because if, suppose this decoupling is greater than roughly the muon mass, for example, then here I'm here's the temperature as a function of time. And so we have at some stage the nu left, the nu right, E plus minus, mu plus minus, gamma, they're all in equilibrium. Then at this decoupling, this drops out and it's no longer in equilibrium, but it has an effective temperature that just drops with the expansion of the universe. Meanwhile, these others are still in equilibrium, but at some temperature around the muon mass, the muons drop out of equilibrium and annihilate. And so what happens at that stage is that the others reheat to a higher temperature, higher than the temperature, effective temperature of these. So this is nu left, E plus minus, gamma. And so, and one can calculate how much reheating using entropy arguments. And furthermore, if the decoupling occurs even earlier, then one can consider tau plus minus, pi plus minus, etc., were at earlier stages in equilibrium and they annihilated. And at some point, one encounters going to higher temperatures. One in at some temperature T sub C, one encounters the quark hadron phase transition above which one has free quarks and gluons. And so if the decoupling occurred at temperatures higher than this, then at this transition, all of the quarks and gluons would have become confined to a smaller number of degrees of freedom, again, reheating all the lighter stuff. And this temperature is not known very well, but we'll follow the early estimates, which I think are still pretty much the range. 150 to 400 MeV. This temperature due, I think, to Gary and Wagner was just the temperature at which, in a reasonable model, the sizes of free hadrons starts to overlap. And this temperature is an estimate of the temperature above which quarks and gluons would be basically asymptotically free. So the bottom line, therefore, is that there, when you take all these things into account, the new right temperature stays fixed while everything else goes through a set of stages which effectively dilute the density. And so there's fewer, but not zero. And the one can calculate the effective delta in nu. This is the 3 you would have without these annihilation and confinement effects times the nu R, well, it's the temperature, effective temperature at nucleosynthesis of the nu R divided by some relevant Big Bang nucleosynthesis temperature to the fourth. So here's the dilution factor. And you can actually use entropy to just estimate that this is this G at BBN over G at the nu R decoupling all to the 4/3, where G again is G boson plus 7/8 G fermion, which is basically, 43 over, I can't read my notes, what is it, Gary? 43 over?
Four.
Over 4 in standard model. Okay, so I'm already over time, and I don't want to go too much longer, so let me just flash a couple of transparencies. This is a calculation that some combination of Keith Olive and Gary and Dave did. This is the temperature in log of temperature in MeV, so TeV, a GeV and 100 GeV, etc. And here's the G of T, and you see it increases fairly slowly, but at some stage it increases very rapidly. This is for a confinement temperature of 150 MeV, and this is for 400. And the point is that if a decoupling occurred up here, then there were so many degrees of freedom associated, especially because of the gluons, but the quarks, that there would have been a huge dilution and one would be relatively safe. But if the decoupling occurs here or in the middle, then the dilution is much less effective and one would have too much helium. Now, so that was the basic story of what they did, and Olive, Steigman, and Schramm did not look in great detail at specific particle physics models to do the calculation. There were subsequent more careful studies by, well, Jose Valle and Gonzalez Garcia and John Ellis and Dimitri Nanopoulos and others, but they looked at specific models, but what they did was they basically only considered the things like E plus E minus goes to Z prime, goes to new right bar, or new left bar. This is not really the complete story, however, because if one's in the early temperature, one has to really consider the interactions of the Z prime and the right-handed neutrinos, also with the muons and the taus and the pions and the quarks and everything, just as one's considering those effects in the entropy and in the expansion rate. And so what Vernon and Heising and I did was put all these ingredients together and tried to look in gory detail at when one takes it into all these account things self-consistently. And I'll just flash a couple of transparencies. This is this ADA model I referred to, a specific example of E6. And in the curves, the black curves are just the decoupling temperature as a function of the Z prime mass, 1 TeV, 2 TeV, 3 TeV, etc. And the circles are for a confinement temperature of 150, and the crosses are for the confinement temperature of 400. And what you see is this decoupling temperature. These curves are without any ZZ prime mixing. These curves are showing that you have to go to quite high masses before you get up to decoupling temperatures that are very high. Here is the effective number of new neutrino species. And here's delta N nu of 2, 1, and then 0.3 is down here, where one would really like to be below this curve. And you see with TC of 150 MeV, no matter, it's hard to get down to that decoupling temperature unless the Z prime mass is rather large, several TeV. If it's the decoupling temperature is, confinement temperature is 400, it's even more difficult. So it's rather stringent constraints. The blue curves are various assumptions about the ZZ prime mixing. These are ones of taking the mixing to be 0.002, which is the experimental limit. And if one just takes that fixed, then the one can produce the new Rs via the Z, just through its mixing effects. If one takes the more realistic mixing assumptions, one gets less stringent constraints there. For the general E6 models, let's just look at this curve. It's didn't come out as well as I would like in the transparency. Let's just look at the left-hand side, which is the one that ignores ZZ prime mixing, and the right-hand side includes it. The decouplings temperatures are shown on the left as a function of this angle theta E6. So here's the chi model, the psi model, the eta model was approximately here. And the decoupling temperatures are for MZ prime of 4 TeV, 3.5, et cetera, down to 500 GeV. And one finds, again, that for most of these theta E6s, one has to go to fairly large masses before one can get a decoupling. Here is the, well, let's just look at this one. This is the bottom curve is the Z prime mass that you would need to have the delta in nu be less than a whatever limit that you really want to. In particular, delta in nu of 0.3 is a curve here that didn't come out very well on the transparency. For most of these theta E6s, you need to have 4 or 5 TeV masses. These constraints are much more stringent than anything that we have from precision electroweak or from the Tevatron. They're comparable to the sensitivity that one might hope to ultimately probe at the LHC or a future linear collider. So if there is a Z prime, at least in this class, which is probably fairly typical, then and if the neutrinos are Dirac, then I think one has fairly robust constraints that are severe, except for one loophole. Notice these curves shoot up to very high TC at one critical value of theta E6, or the constraints on Z2 go away. That is the decoupling map. Of course, there is some magic model.
Paul, on those graphs, the fact that the lowest curve seemed to go down to delta and nu is 0.3 is something you tuned in, or is it some kind of limit that you found?
The lowest curves were the Z2 mass needed to have delta n nu be less than 0.3, and typically it was 4 or 5 TeV.
So if you wanted it to be 0.1, you would have just found a different mass.
Yeah, then you would have to go to higher mass scales. Okay, so
if you believe that delta n nu is less than 0, then it has to be coupled.
Well, first of all, let's not, it would have to decouple. So let me just summarize that with a few words of what all this means. So we have Z prime severely constrained. Even for delta n nu less than 1. And then I put an explanation mark if it's 0.3 and a double explanation if it's less than 0. I mean, if it's less than 0, then one has problems anyway. So let me say less than or equal to. Of course, one can evade this by TeV seesaw or other model without Dirac neutrino. One can evade by psi nu e greater than 0. All of these curves were done for psi nu e equal to 0. But remember, the actual constraint is something like this. I'll just say for definiteness, less than 0.3. So one can certainly compensate a delta n nu by a xi nu e of order 0.01 or 0.02 or something. It's fairly unnatural, hard to generate models that would do that, because a natural scale would be 10 to the minus 10. But people have constructed such models. There have been a number of very interesting papers recently claiming correctly that in the standard BBN with delta n nu having no contributions other than neutrino asymmetries, that all psi nu e, psi nu mu, psi nu tau would have probably equilibrated by neutrino oscillation effects, so they would all be constrained, all be the same, and all be too small to be relevant here. Those calculations are correct in their context, but do not necessarily apply, or they don't apply, if there are other sources, such as the right hand of neutrinos, to contribute to the expansion rate. So even if the equilibration was there, one still would have this as a possibility. Well, basically, the argument is that there are the types of constraints that, let's see how to put it. Those models basically tried to balance a delta n nu due to psi mu, psi tau, and psi e, an expansion rate, against this direct contribution to get a very small number. But if the three quantities are all equal, you can't balance it unless they're all small. That's basically the argument. Also folding in constraints from the CMB. However, if there is some other source not associated with asymmetries to the delta n nu, then you can have, you could have delta n nu of 3, for example, and this to be 0.015 or something, and you could have a fine-tuned cancellation between them, and that doesn't depend on equilibration. I should say the equilibration would have to be checked again too, because the universe is expanding faster, and so one doesn't even know whether there's still equilibration.
In fact, when you came in my office this morning, I was generating contour plots in that plane.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the constraints are very weak,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that if you just, as input, say, I know eta, not from nucleosynthesis, you can't use that anymore because this is non-standard, from MAB. If I know the helium abundance and deuterium abundance, then I have enough parameters to get constraints in the delta n nu psi e plane, or mm-hmm. expansion rate psi e plane. And they're very weak. You're
mm-hmm.
allowed to have more of the delta n nu bigger than 1, provided you want to live with a psi e that's about 0.1 to 0.2.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you allow a more Baroque model with two extra adjustable parameters, the constraints almost go away.
Yeah, that does not violate the equilibration argument.
I don't think so, no.
Last comment is that, yes, in these curves, I should have said this before I took it down, but everybody noticed that there was this loophole. For example, the delta n nu versus theta e 6, the curve sort of looked like this. And there was one critical angle, theta e 6 equal to 0.42 pi, in which the constraints go away. And that's the z prime decouples from nu r at that point. And so when it is now sterile with respect to the z prime, and so one just doesn't have the problem. Yes?
Oh, I'm sorry, I arrived late. So, but in any case, there is a possibility of the z prime, I don't know, that's my question. But there is a possibility of generating an asymmetry just with oscillation. shift if you have these sterile.
Yes, that's right.
You should find, somebody has computed that, if you can generate, of course you keep, you hide, you know, say, the asymmetry. So you generate really an asymmetry in the visible neutrinos. Anybody has checked that?
So Graziella is asking me whether anybody's combined these sorts of ideas with all the work on the four neutrino sterol and this interesting nonlinear effects involving asymmetries, etc. As far as I know, nobody has attempted to combine those ideas. Yeah. Okay. So this is a way out. Oh, of course, there's a severely constrained. So obviously one solution, there's no Z prime. Another is that there's no light Dirac neutrino. Another is that there's a large asymmetry. Fourth is that one's at this magic mixing angle. I forgot to mention that there are also constraints done by Griffos and Mendes and Rizzo and others on supernova 87 constraints on Z primes, much the same physics of draining energy away. And of course, they have the same, those limits are a little bit weaker if you take delta nu to be 0.3, but they're in the same ballpark, totally different systematics. But they have the same loophole. Now, this appears to be very fine-tuned, and I don't have time to go through it, but I will simply say that in a, unfortunately, unwritten paper I'd like to write up, is if you start with this more general U1 chi cross U1 psi scheme, it is very, and using the matter multiplets from E6, it is very easy to find an example of flat directions. You can find flat directions. And when I say can find, what I mean, everything always depends on the sign of some soft mass squared terms. So you get a conclusion, one conclusion if it's positive, another if it's negative. There are flat directions in these models such that the two heavy Z's, one of them is minus 5 over 2 root 10 times the one, the what I'd call the chi, that acquires a mass at perhaps 10 to the 12 along a flat direction, and that the other is 1 over root 24, the orthogonal combination. And it turns out that this one corresponds to this decoupling. So this, what at some point I thought was this fine-tuned loophole, is actually a fairly natural solution to the U1 cross U1. The same idea would apply to any U1 cross U1, not just to the E6 example. So maybe, I won't state it more strongly than that. It's not so fine-tuned. It's a real possibility. And okay, I'll stop at that point.
Question on the role of supersymmetry in any of this when you reach these Z prime masses, and that's one thing. And the second thing, stability of the flat direction changes away from the ordinary Kale.
I haven't I haven't worried about effects of non-standard Kähler or anything like that, and I've taken the view that when you have a direction which is D flat and tree level and at the renormalizability tree level. And usual renormalizable interaction level F flat, then the flatness can be lifted by mass terms, by higher loop corrections, and by higher dimensional operators. And in that case, one can easily get this sort of scenario. But I haven't looked at it in more detail. What was the first question?
Once you reach masses of Z's of 3 to 5 dEV, in your consideration, do you deal with their with the supersymmetry decay, decays in symmetric particles?
The implicitly, but not explicitly. The point is that the decoupling temperatures are typically several hundred MeV is the typical scale on these plots, and it's very hard, except at this decoupling point, to get more than a few hundred MeV. So in practice, we only include thresholds up to the bottom quark. And so our actual curves sort of stop at this point. You would have to be incredibly right on this point to get more, because you would really have to then have the decoupling go up to above the top quark or the sparticle or the exotic thresholds to actually see the thing shooting off to the delta n nu go to zero, and we didn't want to consider that, but it's clear what's happening. But you have to be right on the nose. I mean, you can't be just a little bit off. Anything else?
How is the proton decay?
I'm not considering explicit grand unified theory. If you had a real E6, as I said at the beginning, I was using the E6 quantum numbers, U1 prime quantum numbers, and exotic particle content, just because it was a simple example of an anomaly-free construction. We are not assuming a real E6 grand unified theory, because if you had a true E6 grand unified theory, then if one of these U1 primes survived to low energies, then the colored partner of the Higgs would be couldn't get a mass larger than the U1 prime breaking scale, and it would mediate instantaneous proton decay. So it's not a grand unified theory. And the reason I stuck with that is that's really the only very good model of this type. One can write down models that are sort of bottom up with exotics, but cancel all the anomalies. Or one can take concrete string constructions. We've done that too, which have all these features, but they tend to have complicated patterns of exotics, et cetera, and they're not very illuminating. So that's why we worked with this example.